Okay, so today Lara and I were supposed to talk about gravitational wave searches, and there was a number of random requests made on the Monday meeting about things we should talk about. So we both prepared a few things, but really, if we're not answering questions you're interested in, then please sidetrack it to the questions you do want to hear about. So mostly I'll talk about match filtered searches for coalescing binaries, because that's what I spend my days doing. And if there's things about the unmodeled burst searches, that's what Lara spent her time on. So between us, we can cover those things. If you care about pulsar signals, then you're out of luck.
We don't.
I didn't think so.
Don't even mention this.
You're being recorded, you know. Okay, so I clearly haven't taught enough yet, because I still can't write on the board and speak at the same time. Otherwise, my writing goes totally wonky. So, compact binary waveform. We normally talk about there being sort of 15 or 17 parameters involved. For today, I'm going to skip anything to do with precession, because it complicates things, and I can't do it on the back of an envelope. And I'm also going to skip higher order harmonics in the waveform. So, what we're going to basically worry about is the parameters we care about for the waveform are going to be the distance to the source, the position on the sky, which we tend to call theta and phi rather than RA and dec. It's your choice. But what we really care about is where the source is relative to the detector, right? And so it's more convenient to use these.
Steve, are you going to say anything? So you're going to ignore the higher order harmonics,
yeah.
But would you comment anything on where you
can
resolve
them,
where you
can
get something done?
I'll say a little bit, yeah. I mean, by and large, I think, you know, if we sort of, I'm pitching this, I think, mostly binary neutron star, you know, for the GRB case. In that higher order harmonics, so if people don't know what this is about, if you picture a binary system orbiting, we always say that the leading order gravitational waveform is emitted at twice the orbital frequency, right? Well, it's pretty obvious in the system I've just drawn, if I swap M1 and M2, the system is not symmetric, right? So if you only emit it at twice the orbital frequency, this sort of doesn't, then you'd expect a symmetry. So if I swap this, I'd expect exactly the same thing. Clearly that doesn't exist, so you're going to emit actually at one times the orbital frequency, and also 3, 4, 5, and so on and so on, okay? By and large, we ignore everything other than twice the orbital frequency. It's the dominant harmonic. And so,
by what factor? I mean, how much power comes on in the other?
It depends upon two things. It depends upon mass ratio, significantly, and also depends upon the orientation of the binary. If I'm face on to the binary, this is the strongest emission in the second harmonic, and so you really have to have a significant mass ratio before you start to care about the subleading terms. If I'm edge on, actually, you know, this is there are positions where I basically get nothing from the leading order. So there are systems that I wouldn't see at all, you know, in the leading order that I would get the higher harmonics from. Now, of course, if you volume weight everything and you care about what fraction of source is, well, these ones where I don't see the leading order term at all, they're going to be a tiny fraction of the sources. Because you,
but this contribution is part of the waveforms. It's part of the search strategy and all that.
It is not part of the search strategy. I mean, they're subleading it. I mean, what, the 10% level, I guess, for fairly high mass ratios.
The EOB Harada Mo paper has a nice plot that shows from the basically the contribution. You know, the amplitude, the 2-2 mode, and then the subleading order modes, and it's something like an order of magnitude down, isn't it, on average?
Yeah, unless you go close to manager.
Yeah.
But certainly for black hole neutron star, because you said for neutron star, it's okay, but black hole neutron star, mass ratio 6, you know, 4, etc., you could have some effect that are not negligible, some power in these higher harmonics, but at the moment, so there is no search done with higher harmonics, but people are investigating whether, you know, it's going to be important or not.
But that's part of the source modeling.
But the other thing I'll get, when we quote distances, we quote distances if we're only seeing the 2-2 mode, right? So if you did a search that had high harmonics in, you could maybe see a bit further at some additional complication, but then there's, you know, maybe increasing your false alarm rate doing that, so then there's the trade-off there. So it's not like by ignoring the high harmonics, we're not bringing 200 megaparsecs down to, you know, it's not like the mismatch between a non-spinning and a spinning signal where you actually reduce your range. When we calculate that 200 megaparsecs, it's calculated using the amplitude from the TC mode.
But it's not, I mean, I guess my question is, it's not being ignored at the level where it might be degenerate with other effects, like measuring the equation of state.
No,
I see. Like if it's a 10%
no, time, no, it's because the equation of state you mentioned from the very end, the higher harmonics may affect, for example, the dorsal black hole more accumulating synchrotron ratio in the inspiral part. So I wouldn't say that.
To reduce its uncertainty in the mass ratio, in the mature mass is well measured, but the other one we discussed could have a relatively large error.
So
higher harmonics help in reducing that window.
People have written papers where they say yes, including higher harmonics can help. But you know, by and large, what we've sort of been talking about here and in the hallways is the first handful of detections with advanced LIGO. Most of them are coming in at SNR 10 or 15. If you give me a 10% effect, I find it hard to see it's going to have a huge impact on what we can do. Right? If you go to third generation detectors, I can believe suddenly, you know, this helps. And most of the papers about how important higher harmonics are were pitched at LISA, where the binary black hole signals would have had signal noise ratios of millions. Right?
Can you discuss this issue that the power in the higher harmonics is strictly for quasi-circular, these estimates? Like
yes.
Yeah.
Because it's not true.
Eccentric would be
different.
Right.
What's the, is it lack of waveforms, or why not just,
because
computationally
is it? Right. So the issue is, which I will get to in a bit more detail, right? Some of the other parameters, right, then I have distance, sky location, I have polarization angle and inclination angle, which basically tell me the orientation of the source, right? It's face on, the inclination angle 0, the polarization angle basically tells me, so the orientation of the ellipse if it's not face on. And then I have a coalescence phase. When I do the standard search without ignoring higher harmonics, there's a nice thing that happens, which is basically these two parameters, all they do is change the amplitude and phase of the waveform. So every waveform I think about is the same up to amplitude and phase, right? Which makes the search dead easy. Right? I can just maximize over these parameters, I don't have to worry. If I include higher order harmonics, then a face-on waveform will only have 2-2, basically, and an edge-on waveform will have no 2-2, and it'll actually look different. And so then it just makes the search more complicated. No one's worked out an efficient way to do the search, including these, right? Because you make your waveform more complicated, you put up your trials factor. And no one's found a way that actually, you know, you can increase the trials factor a little bit and actually get more sensitivity. So right now the strategy is search without higher harmonics, and then when you get to parameter estimation, you've found the signal and you're trying to explore the parameters, throw them in then. And
so
I don't think that's going to change.
Is that being done, the parameter estimation?
Some of them do. Not all of the models. Again, I think the problem is these waveforms are more complicated, they take longer to generate, so if you want a quick look, you probably ditch it, but some of the parameter estimation guys do have them all in.
But maybe it's good to say that people are, even for research, people are doing studies to understand better whether this can be...
Yeah.
So Alessandro just posted up in my grad student, they're working on a study that basically figures out how much you lose with the higher harmonics for the focused on the binary black hole search, which is where this is most important. And you don't lose that much, right, for the systems we're going to get. It's for the search, it's subdominant, and so you don't lose that much.
And that's a SNR dependent statement?
Yeah.
It's an SNR dependent statement.
Yeah,
it's
a threshold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how, so, you know, if you get to 12, then that's the imaging.
Well, if you go to more 20,
that's the source.
Yeah, you have to go to very.
But then still searching without them is fine. You're still going to find them.
So at that point, then you just find them and then you do the post.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing you want to do is make sure that, you know, if we're quoting, we can detect the SNR, right? Right. There are systems, because we've, and the answer to that is no, it's fine.
There you go. So it's okay. I told you to sidetrack the question. All right, so then we got the nine parameters now. Distance, sky location, these are orientation angles, a phase. And it's an arbitrary phase, and you know, this is just, is the binary oriented like this or like this? And you have to pick a time at which to do this. And we normally say the time at coalescence and the phase at coalescence. If you're more comfortable with thinking at the phase at, you know, when the thing's emitting at 100 hertz or whatever, it's just some phase parameter and some time parameter. Right, and it just tells you the time the thing's going to coalesce and the phase when it does, or 100 hertz, or whatever you like, and the two masses. And so those are the nine parameters we care about. and so this would be non-spinning, right? So then in principle, there's, you know, there's chi 1 and chi 2, which are vectors which describe the spins. I'm by and large going to ignore these. Turns out that if you just do aligned spins, so if the spin is aligned with the orbital angular momentum, in this case, the spins would be poking out of the board or into the board, then the plane of the binary doesn't process. And then actually most of the tricks we have for the non-spinning search just go through. And we don't have to worry. Again, it comes back to this point. If there's no precession and I change the angles of the waveform just looks the same up to amplitude and phase. Once I add precession, then depending on how I view the system, the waveform can look quite different. So we can actually sort of deal with, you know, chi 1 and chi 2 for a line system. So these are sort of the parameters we care about.
I mean, even if you add spin, they're not fully 3 degrees of freedom, right? Because the spins are conserved for magnitude, so you really only have 2 degrees of freedom for each spin. The precession changes the direction, not doesn't speed up the spin or slow them down.
It's just for my binary, the you know, I have spin vectors for my binary black holes, and they can be pointing.
Sure. So right, but the magnitudes are conserved, so that's one less.
Yeah. But these are the intrinsic parameters of the binary system.
Okay. And there's an open question with spin. I don't think we fully understood is. Of these 6 degrees of freedom in the spins, which ones actually affect the waveform at a level that we need to care about it, and which ones don't? And we know, you know, that the spin in the component of the spin component in the direction of the orbital angular momentum we care about. So then, if I have a single detector, this is a standard thing we write down. Right? If we have one detector, then what it's sensitive to is these response functions, which basically tell you how sensitive the detector is based on where the source is in the sky to the plus polarization and the cross polarization of the gravitational waves. Okay. For now, I want to write this somewhat differently because I think it makes it easier to understand or easier to motivate how we do our search. So what we actually see in our detector, there's an overall amplitude term, then there's the waveform, and I've just written it as H0 and H pi halves. You just imagine this being basically a sine wave. This is the cosine part, and that's the sine part. They're just 90 degrees out of phase.
There's a sine.
And these probably should be twos, but it doesn't really matter. It's just an angle. Right? And then there's...
I'm not saying anything. I didn't say it. Go ahead.
All right, so this is the sort of the cosine part of the waveform, the sine part of the waveform, and then there's a phase that just tells you what the phase in the waveform is. So, and there's obviously a time, right? The time at which the waveform is coalescing in the detector. And so in terms of those parameters over there, the amplitude is going to depend upon the distance, the position in the sky through the response functions, the inclination angle and the polarization angle. This is the observed phase in the detector. It's actually slightly different than the sort of this phase of coalescence. And so it will depend upon the inclination angle, the polarization angle, the sky position, and the phase of coalescence. Okay, so you can sort of break these things up. There's four things we sort of we can measure. There are four things we can measure in our detector. We can measure the time of coalescence, we can measure what the waveform looks like, we can measure an overall amplitude and an overall phase. Right, so those are the four things we measure from those 11 that we might care about. And they sort of break up like this, right? The time we observe in our detector is the time of coalescence, which we normally would take as like the geocentric time. And then, of course, there's a time delay to our detector, just depending upon where it is on the Earth. And so it'll differ. Obviously, these all depend upon detector location as well. Right? So the time we observe in the detector is the time at the Earth center minus some light travel time, depending on direction to the source. The waveforms depend upon the masses, and for now, you know, the aligned spin components. And changing these actually changes the shape of the waveform. And then this overall phase parameter basically depends upon all the angles, where the thing is in the sky, how it's oriented, how it's inclined, and what its phase angle is. And the overall amplitude depends upon the distance and all the angles except this phase angle. And so, you know, if you imagine doing the search, the way we deal with this, these waveforms, we template over this big space, right? And so the way you extract these parameters is by doing the search over all these space, you know, over the template space, and find the one that matches best. Okay? I'm not really going to talk any more about getting the, you know, degeneracies between masses and, you know, spins and everything. There's been some talk already that basically we pull out chirp mass very accurately because that's the leading order contribution to the waveform. We don't get the other things quite so accurately.
Just a question, so if you did include like spin precession, wouldn't you expect it to primarily affect the amplitude? With the time modulation?
Yeah. Yes. So you could probably still write it as an overall factor, and then you could think of these.
A of t.
Yeah.
That's probably.
Yeah, so there'll be an envelope on the waveform.
I suppose it changes your phase too.
Yeah.
Yeah, the most, when you look at the waveform, the most visible effect is amplitude modulation, but there's a subtle phase modulation in there. That's what the match filter cares about.
Yeah. The point is, it makes everything a whole lot more complicated. So that's how you get that. The time, you basically, you know, you match filter and you calculate the signal to noise ratio at every time step and you just find the peak. And you're, you know, this is basically what gives you your localization. You just find the time in different detectors and you do time delays and you work out where the heck the thing came from in the sky. Okay? So if you sort of think about it hierarchically, the template gives you the masses and the spins. Time delays give me localization. And then I'm trying to measure. So I need multiple detectors, obviously, to get localization. But then in one detector, all I measure is an overall amplitude and phase of my signal. And so if I only have one detector, there's no hope of pulling out any of these things. With one detector, we can't tell you where the thing came from in the sky, other than if you want to be a probabilist, a Bayesian person, you'd say it's most likely to come from where our detectors are most sensitive, which is directly overhead. That's about all you can say about where it came from. And people do like to say this. But so you need time delays to work out where it came from. Once you know where it came from, if you look at these, then these guys are gone. And I have four parameters left. I have distance and the orientation of the binary. So then in principle, if I know where the source came from and I have two detectors measure it, I get an amplitude and phase in each detector. So I can get these final four parameters, which are the ones we might care about for beaming angles and distances and what have you. So So you can imagine doing this in two ways. Either we localize with timing from our detectors, or you know, a gamma ray burst or something goes off, in which case we know the sky location. Okay. One thing that people had asked about was, what's the difference between range and horizon? Because we use these two different numbers, and we mostly do it just to confuse everybody. That's slightly flippant. There's a reasonable explanation of why this happened, right? If I'm building a detector,
what's that? That's what they use magnitudes, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Just one comment here. This last thing that it's true that you don't have very well. You have a lot of degenerates between the distance and the.
That's right. I'll come back to that in a bit.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So the point here, I mean, am I supposed to think of it as you really do it in this order? Like you're not marginalizing over everything at once. You're really using the template, and then separately, once you have a template, you do time delays, and then.
There's correlations between all of these things, right? Now they're not too bad, because actually, if I change the masses and the detectors all have the same noise curve, I'll get the same time offset in all the detectors. So if my template's wrong, I'll actually get the same time offset. So I'll probably get the sky location about right. And I think even if I change these parameters, I don't think I'll screw up my recovery of the inclination and polarization angle too badly.
So this is the breakdown of the correlation of the errors.
Yeah.
But there are correlations between everything. But it's more that I can't get my head around 10 parameters in one go. And so I, you know, this to me is sort of a way to break it down into groups of two or three that I can think about at a time. And, always be aware that if I got these wrong, it will surely have an effect on the knock-on effect on everything. But, you know, I think it just breaks it down into blocks that are more manageable. Does that make sense? All right. So range versus horizon. If you're building a detector, what you want to know is how often am I likely to see something? Okay? And in that case, what you care about is what's the volume of space I'm sensitive to? And then if my favorite astrophysicist over here tells me the expected rate, I can work out.
He can build the only one.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why he's your favorite.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, he's giving me a three order of magnitude uncertainty. It's pretty good. Yeah. So you know, if someone tells me here's the expected rate, and I know the volume of space I'm sensitive to, then I can work out how many signals I expect to see, and this is good. If I'm doing a search, what I care about is for this given signal, at these given positions, would I have expected to see it, right? If I'm doing simulations into my detector, I care about would I have expected to see that particular signal at that particular point on the sky with these parameters, because it's a way I can test my search. It's a way I know if a GRB went off over there, would I be able to say, should I have seen it or not? And the the way you then want to do that is you know that the place you're most sensitive is directly overhead the detectors and a face-on binary. And that's your horizon. So it's the best you could possibly ever do. Right? So the perfect signal, directly overhead, face on. And then to get to the range, well, you have to worry about two things. One is this sort of, I'm going to have a horrible attempt to draw the response of the detector. So if it goes really bad, we'll pull up the laptop. But basically, directly overhead, so what I'm drawing here is basically the square root of F plus squared plus F cross squared. So it's how sensitive the detector is. Overhead, it's maximal. Down the arms, it's half, because basically if a signal's coming down this arm, one arm is going to expand and contract, the other one's not going to change at all, so I'm half as sensitive. If it comes down the V between the two arms, I get zero. And so you get some sort of peanut-shaped thing like this. And I can point you to several papers where they actually have a much better drawing. But so you're best overhead, you're not so good in the plane, et cetera, et cetera. And then to work out the range, what you do is you take this, and actually there's only two angles here. So when you could do this integral over f plus f cross, you know, on a piece of paper if you wanted to work out the average of these. But we also want to include averaging over these other angles, inclination, polarization, and phase. So what you do is you average over sky position, inclination, polarization, and phase. and you work out basically the volume of sources you're sensitive to. So it will be some funny peanut shape. And then you map that to basically a sphere. And then, you know, so I can work out some volume over here that I'm sensitive to. And I map this to a sphere with the same volume. And so then the radius here is just, what is it, cube root of this. And I need some 3 upon 4 pi. Probably get inside. Right, so you just work out the volume of space you're sensitive to, and then say, what's the radius of the equivalent sphere? And you can see that if I'm doing a search and I know the range, it's not actually that useful. Because my range is 200 megaparsecs, I stuck something in at 200 megaparsecs, I didn't see it. Is that because my search is broken? Or is that because it came from a point in the sky where my detector is not? And so what's more useful for us is actually to use the horizon distance. And then the other thing you can work out is an effective distance, which is it's a function. So the effective distance is a function of all these things. Such that if you're directly overhead, and well, this is bigger than or equal to d. So the point is, rather than that was not a, it's not a particularly useful equation at the moment. Let me try and explain. So what you want to do is you say there was a source and it came from this part in the sky and it was oriented like this and that, right? I know the waveform it will emit. That is equivalent to a source directly overhead my detector, face on, but obviously at a bigger distance, equal or bigger distance. And that's my effective distance. Right? And so it's basically, you know, it's just saying, obviously,
the best case scenario.
That's right, yeah. And so then I can compare my effective distance to my horizon distance. And if the effective distance is less than the horizon distance, I should have seen the thing. Right? Because the horizon distance is, you know, how far I can see the optimal thing. So that's why for doing a search, it does make sense to have this horizon. Whereas for doing the you know, building the next detector, all you care about is the range, you care about the volume. I think I've confused most people by now. No?
The effective distance is just related to the coming
A. It's related, yes. It's 1 over the amplitude. Or some factor, yeah.
But that's not the same as the parameter B.
No, D is the physical distance.
D is the actual distance.
So D, if your binary was edge on at some physical distance, then it looks, you can't tell the difference between that and a binary that's face on further away.
Okay.
Because you're only seeing, you know, if it's face on, you see the plus and cross polarization. If it's edge on, you only see one polarization, so you're not seeing as much. So it looks like a face on binary that's further away. Because we can't disentangle the inclination of the distance, we just say, well, when quoting distance sources, let's pretend they're all face on, and then at least it gives us a metric.
Okay. And this is a pure SNR statement. I mean, this is not looking at details. What forms it?
It's just the amplitude, yeah. And
so that's what you mean by saying they're all face on, huh?
Yes. If there is not something completely ordered.
What do you mean?
So that's what you mean when you say also is just like based on like this. You're not assuming this,
but
you said, or based on, you're just mapping them.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm mapping them. It's true, actually, that most sources we see will be face-on.
And it sounds scary.
No, well, most sources we see will be face-on, right? Because this H+, I should probably write down this H+, H cross. Anyway, let me finish here. The only thing you really need to remember is that the horizon is 2.26 times the range. Okay? So if you look up your favorite, you know, configuration of the advanced detectors, and you want to know how far we can see ideally, then you just need that factor. And there's two things that contribute to that. One is averaging over the sky, and one is averaging over the polarization inclination angles. And so if you care about the case of GRBs, which you think are probably face on, this is why people say, for a GRB, on average, you can see about 1.5 times that range. Because if you assume it's nearly face on, you actually get more amplitude in the gravitational waves. And I should probably write that formula down. Okay.
So what are the numbers
so far for advanced LIGO? What's our horizon distance?
Oh, what are these? 200 megaparsecs is the design.
Okay. It's 200. It's not 150 or 250. It's
200.
203 or...
No, but why don't we show that that figure that shows with different noise curves starting from the beginning of online, you know, when advanced light is going to be online, how that distance is going to change? We discussed this at the Princeton meeting. I think it is a nice figure to show.
Do we have that?
Because we cannot just quote it one.
Just show.
No, it's on the web. It's not secret, it's on the web.
It's on, if you don't want to show it, if you don't show the...
if you connect to the Princeton workshop.
Show the commissioning.
Just say, I'm Frank.
Frank, you're
cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
There's nothing
in that. I know. Well, except
it's a public,
except the Virgo. Where am I going?
No, they allocate those numbers in
the All right, then I'm just going to go.
I'm sure you guys keep
our
finger around this.
Could
you show us the peanut balls around it?
Yes, I can, because I can't draw the damn thing. Yes, I need to.
The only reason I'm not sure the Princeton one is because it has the Poincare, right?
So we've known that vector is 2.26 for about a decade, but we had some code that used an approximation to 2.26, which was about 5% off, which is great. So there's the peanut, and I think this is the one you care about. That's the peanut squared, if you ever wanted to know how to square a peanut.
Are those things the arms?
The arms would be coming out here and here. The dead spots are between the arms.
Between the arms.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the sensitivity at the arms is half. This is a Schutz paper in CQG.
And the thing that makes the 2.26 awkward is that the source also has a peanut.
Yeah.
So you have to multiply the two peanuts together. It's a weird sensitivity pattern, and you actually have to Monte Carlo, and you can't do it analytically.
In five dimensions, and so yeah.
So basically, you throw down sources and you say what's inside the range, what's outside the range, and you get 2.26 for the.
Can you do that analytically?
Well, you can do numerically solve integrals. That's what the Monte Carlo is doing.
Yeah,
Monte Carlo takes about a second.
Okay.
You just throw a million random.
There's a lot of confusion for a while because people said, I can do this integral, I get root 5. It's not root 5. That's when you can get analytical over that. It's 2.26.
So since we have this article up and since I'm being recorded, I will say, by and large, there's good things in this article, but when it says how much improvement you get if you did the search coherently, it's wrong. Okay. The statement is, if you did the search coherently, what he says here is, if you did the search coherently, you'd buy it, get a factor of 10 in volume or something.
So why is wrong? Is it the calculation?
Because the assumptions are just totally incorrect.
Okay. Maybe we should explain what it means to do a search coherently.
Yeah. Okay, let me just...
So what I thought was the coincident version of this is what's rough. But you're saying it's the coherent part.
Well, it's the difference between the two. Anyway, let me... We should get on to that. This just for fun, is the peanuts for Hanford, Livingston, Virgo over here. So this is actually on the sky somehow. And that's if you add a detector in Japan. And what you see is this thing starts to get more spherical. I think he even has... The other thing I was saying, if you... This is the number, the green is the number of sources that you'd expect as a function of inclination angle, right? So it's just uniform in cos iota, right? And the red is the distribution of observed sources you would expect. And it's just that you get more signal if the thing's nearly face on. And so you see, you know, there's a huge sort of bias here, or observational bias. Non-observational bias at present. Are such things allowed? Right? And then these are some, here you go. Here's our own peanut. Here's what have we added here? Two LIGOs plus Virgo. This has got one in Japan. This has got one in Australia. And you see, by the time you've got sort of five or six detectors, you've got pretty good all-sky coverage. Right, that's really the point.
And this takes into account the different detectors have different sensitivities.
I think he's assuming they're all equal at this one.
Yeah. Which is not true. The LIGO is more sensitive than Virgo, which is more probably about the same as Kagura.
Yeah. LIGO India will lag by 5 years. All the others and so.
For what it's worth, it's a very nice. And this approach is very easy, so you can just it's completely straightforward to adjust for sensitivity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever want to just calculate this yourself?
This, I didn't show you this document?
No, I'm interested in, I'll ask that question later, but I'm interested in the relative sensitivities for the question of localization.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. This is... That's it. Can I get it in there?
When you had the 2.26 for the horizon versus the range, that was one detector, that's what it covers?
Yeah.
Okay, so you effectively can get more volume. You have lots of detectors, is that right?
Yeah. All our rates are calculated using a single detector SNR8, so in that sense they're conservative.
So yeah, because if you had all the detectors and you started to approach you're covering the whole sky, then you could get up to...
You could get 440 megaparsecs.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, the core of this is, you know, when we say our range is 200 megaparsecs, we could quite easily come back and say we've seen the GLB and we think it's a 400 megaparsecs.
Or 600.
Or 600, right.
Okay.
So can we get a galaxy counter?
Yeah. I mean, what we normally say is...
Well, you really trivialize the volume, so we can...
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying, yeah. I mean, that's for rates, but
yeah.
But there are other questions.
So I mean, people have made assumptions that, you know, we're going to do maybe out of... You know, Tree and Nancy putting a galaxy catalog together out to 200 megaparsecs, right, to do, you know, targeted pointings. But our sources could come from.
Yes, we should tell them that you're starting 400.
Yeah, they'll be happy to hear that.
Yeah.
I mean, the horizon distance is a set of measure zero, right? So it's a little. I mean, I think the volume is much more relevant for anything.
Although
you never get something exactly.
Although if you go to GRBs, right, you might argue that at least of these, you know, of the two factors, right, of the detector sensitivity factor and then the orientation of the binary factor, you pretty much face on. So one of them will be almost ideal.
Right, if you have a good network. That's
yeah. Right. And then, okay. Anyway, so these you'll probably be able to look at in a few weeks'
so
time.
So is the range or the horizon?
These are ranges because they're written by people who build detectors. And so they like. So this is... This is rough. This Albert showed something similar to this in his talk. This is a rough timeline of you know how things might evolve, and you'll see there's big error bars on everything. And there's bigger error bars on low frequency, because at high frequency it's just shot.
For the final, as no, I don't know.
Well, the final's the target, right?
The final is design sensitivity, right? And so it's sort of, 2015, LIGO's at sort of 60 megaparsecs, Virgo is not on, or if it is, it's not at a comparable sensitivity. 2016, 17, about 100 here and about 40-odd here. And then, by and large, LIGO's about a factor of 2 more sensitive than Virgo until you get to design at 2020 or something, at which stage LIGO India should be in the game and CAGRA should be in the game. So it's not a bad...
The other thing that's important is these distances are quoted for a 1.4, 1.4 binary neutron star system. So the GRB is a black hole neutron star.
It's much, much worse. Because just because of the low frequencies, it's really short.
You mean at early?
Yeah. No, it just looks like you're doing much worse on the low frequency stuff in the early configuration.
Yeah, that's why you have a 60 megaparsec range opposed to a 200 megaparsec range.
But actually, the relative range between neutron star, black hole will be about equal for all of these. Because the neutron star, black hole still sweeps right through to, 300-400 hertz, so you get most of it.
The thing that's kind of surprising when you look at it, every time we look at these plots, we look on a log scale, the match filter is linear, right? If you want to figure out, if you want to eyeball this stuff, then you should plot f to minus 7/3 over s under f on a linear scale,
right.
And it's shocking how much of the power comes from the bucket.
I see.
Okay.
As long as you merge somewhere close to the bucket, the rest
of it. If you merge it at 200-300 hertz, you get all the power.
So what's the number for tensor mass?
The range? It's about a factor of 5. And neutron star black hole is about a factor of
20. I tell you, it's a 2525, it's about 3.2
gigabytes. So do we know how many times now?
Observation?
Yeah.
What's the
crystal?
I think
he meant
30,
if I remember.
Say that again.
What's the highest inferred mass for
solar velocity?
Or, yeah, it's about, what is the system? It's like 30. I have to look it up.
I just know 2525 because it's the number I was looking at. So
but there is one system that has a massive black hole like that. Most of them are 10.
But if we're talking about factor of 5, that's orders of magnitude on the volume.
The thing is, right, the increase in range going from a neutron star to a neutron star black hole buys you about 10 times as much volume. But the rates these guys give us are about 10 times lower. And the same neutron star to neutron star black hole, you again gain another factor of 10 in volume, and he knocks the rates down by a factor of 10.
Barney black hole rates are designed on 1 to 1,000 a year.
But if you look at the expected rates of the three sources, they're basically equal.
And, the implicit rate without it, but the observed rate is going to be
about equal. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So the number of no rates is from intermediate mass black holes or.
No,
So, in terms of comparing Virgo and LIGO for localizations, so the difference in volume is factor 4 or something like that between them.
Well, it looks much more. I mean, it looks like Virgo is almost irrelevant from the volume.
It's a quarter of the volume.
Well, at least the number is.
Because it was 130 or
70 to 140.
No. I was comparing the final.
The final.
140 versus 110. Okay. Yeah, something like that. So it's about a quarter. So then, does that mean that only a quarter will have localizations, or once you detect something in two detectors, you can dig deeper into the noise and the third one?
What I would expect. I'm trying to find the picture of the localization. It seems to have gone away.
From your talk.
Yeah, I can get it from there. Should have been in this document, though.
So these things, so the 2015 is, like, is everyone feeling pretty confident about these numbers now?
Like the 15, 60, and 40, like that's what we're talking about.
Well, that's the plan.
Yeah. Well, predictions are hard, especially about the future, right?
Right. Like, you give us twice all a new car if it doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing.
That's what I remember him saying.
So. I mean, there's a roadmap for doing this. Advanced lightning commissioning is going well.
So
we don't know what problems we're going to hit until we hit them, but.
I mean, there was this, I mean, just for my own, I mean, so there used to be this, you go on the web, and there was this noise curve for this no signal recycling error, I forget, the early, the first.
No, that's the final, it's a zero that you.
So actually, let's just pull this up.
The early LIGO curve is basically, the current early LIGO curve is a curve that has some signal recycling. It has excess, but it has artificially excess power at low frequencies. It's a low power configuration. It has some zero detune signal recycling because they're now a bit more confident they can do that earlier rather than later, and it gives some improvement in the range. But it has an artificial, mystery noise at low frequencies.
In about a month, I think you should be able to download these noise curves.
Okay.
But they're sort of under review. And but the one you're talking about.
So, but physically, so why?
This one is the high power zero detune that people have been talking about for a long time.
The other one
you're talking about was this no signal recycling, which did something like this.
Yes.
Right?
And that was a pretty good noise. I mean,
that was.
My brothers like that.
But that was horrible for localization. Because it's got no high frequency.
That's right.
Yeah, so you got most of the signals and localized none of them.
So was there a choice within the collaboration we want to focus on getting better high frequency?
Is it
hardware issues that are driving whatever this happened, or is there a choice being made, this is the performance we want at high frequency versus low frequency, and we're going to kind of shoot through the middle here, and this is the design we want.
What's being driven is what's the best path to get us to the final design, right? That final design is how high power signal recycling.
So it's not, for example, what's the best path for first detection?
No, actually, it is the also the.
It is the path for first detection.
To optimize for neutron star, neutron star, and it's trying not to have very high power from the beginning because people expect more programs with high power. And so they will concentrate more on the low frequency part, improving at low frequency with the suspension system, etc. And then only at the very end, you see the car will be pushed down at the high power. But the target is at the beginning, I think, neutron star, neutron star.
But one other way to answer your question, right, is this no signal recycling mirror, but this configuration, right? If you went that way and then put signal recycling in, it's never been done in a LIGO detector. It's been done in GEO. If you got to there and then said, okay, now I'm going to stick in signal recycling, it doesn't give you long to get it right. And if that's the only thing you're trying to fix, it just. So I think people are now saying, let's get it in early, get some experience with it, and fiddle with sort of all the components a bit more together. So that's why it's changing to this sort of thing.
For example, if you look at the BNS optimized, which uses the signal cycle, the tuning, with respect to the final, you gain a little bit, but it's not from 200 to 215 megaparts.
I think some of the decision will be made close to as the time approaches, right? So once we have the later configuration running, there will be some soul searching.
I mean, the current plan is to start with a dual recycled interferometer because we have experience in the 40 beta, so people are more confident they can put signal recycling in earlier. Like Steve said, they fear that if we don't put it in early, it's not going to get commissioned properly because we're actually building a dual recycled interferometer, not initial LIGO with a signal recycling mirror.
Right.
And it also helps you optimize the BNS range early at lower laser powers, which is the primary goal. Okay.
But if I would give you the take-home message, right? Early is about a factor of 10 in volume more than what we've searched already. So this will bring our 10 times the sensitivity we've had, 10 times the VT we've already searched. And if you get somewhere near there, you'll stop and run. If I had to bet, the time that we stop will be driven by the commissioners. They'll say, all right, we've put a bunch of systems in, we need to just shake them down for 3 months, or we're stuck, we don't know where to go next, let's see how things work. It won't be driven by an exact horizon distance. And then the next one's another factor of 10 in volume, and then this one's another factor of 10 in volume. And that's sort of, you know, the way to picture it, and so that gets you down to the factor of 1,000. So, picture
so if we take the most optimistic rates, at what range do we get to a detection rate of 1 per year?
Should be a table in here.
The figures in Lisa's talk.
There was a nice table in here.
By the way, so I checked it. This ICTN X1 has a 23 to 33 solar mass black hole. So that's the estimate for its mass.
How much? Sorry.
23 to 33, so it's bigger.
Is that unusual for it to be so
big? There's not that. So there's one other system that has around 20, and the rest are all like 10, 7 to 10.
But there's a selection bias on that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
it's
good.
Well,
I mean, it's
for the rates.
But it's easy. I mean, the neutron star rate is most. It's 10 to the minus 5 per cubic megaparsec per year, down to 10 to the minus 8 per cubic megaparsec per year.
So
10
to the minus 5.
Yeah. So it's about a 60 megaparsec gets you that. Right, and then the 100 megaparsec one gets you, roughly speaking, the sort of this 10 to the minus 6, which some people will call the best guess rate, but other people tell you, you know, to stay well away from words like that. And so yeah, it's the first runs that get you to the top end of the rate.
So like, if I understood it, you're saying you're not going to really do a science run?
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's going to be a few months.
It'll be a 3 month.
You know, we used to do week long science runs in actual
life. Right. I mean, 4 weeks. Maybe some science runs would be done.
Yeah, no,
it's going to be like a month at 60, 3 months at 100, 6 months at 150, so, and then run.
And some of those science run, there may be some tweaking and changing.
So, it's not you know, if you're using these rates, you know. I mean, that's per year.
Yeah. I'm just trying to get a sense of at what point things get interesting.
Yeah, the first run it's really the top end of the rate. The second run is you're in the thick of things, sort of gets realistic.
You mean the
100 megaparsec? Yeah, and you were asking what happens with localization, and this is LIGO Virgo at design, and you know even there there's a you know LIGO's almost double Virgo, and you see there's lots of points on the sky that the localization is pretty terrible. Right.
Because those are ones where the system was not detected.
I think a lot of what's happening for these, it's a simple calculation. But I'm requiring at least a signal noise ratio of 12 in the network, and SNR of at least 5 in 2 detectors. And so I think a bunch of these, what's happening is you're seeing it strongly in LIGO and barely at all in Virgo, and so you're not going to localize. Our average signal here may be kind of SNR 884. And a signal noise ratio of 4 in Virgo, you know, you're going back to half of that ring on the sky. A lot of the time.
I can't remember. The Virgo time frame is, this is in the final thing.
LIGO minus 2 years.
So that's about, yeah. But the whole way through, the ratio of sensitivities is close to 2 to 1, you know, through the predicted commissioning path. So, you know, based on BNS at 160 megaparsecs to make this little plot, if you wanted to scale back, just, you know, the ranges are 100 megaparsecs, just bring the systems in by a factor of 2 as well, and, you know, that's your average detection. It'll look about the same.
But you're still getting some fairly reasonable localizations in some parts of the sky. I'm just wondering if...
So, yeah, that's... The blue curve is the one you want to look at. And this is back to Dan's question. There's no SRF.
The design, when the localization is even worse, what can you do? Can you do any?
But before design, localization is
not... You have this slide.
Before we get away from this slide, I'm just wondering, so the fact that the blue curve only goes up to 50% cumulative fraction, that's because some of the sources are just not detected by Perova.
So what I assumed on that curve was an 80% lifetime for all the detectors, right? So there will just be some fraction of sources where only two detectors were on, right? And we can't localize them for sure. And then there are others which, the Virgo just didn't see it well enough. And then there are others which are, the place you don't localize is if your signal lies in the plane of the detectors, right? Because you can just move it 10 degrees and barely change the time delays. And so all three of these effects are causing this thing to kind of plateau.
So the duty cycle is killing
it. The duty cycle? If you take the duty cycle, it's only up to, it only comes up about there. If you say all three detectors are on, you're only about sort of 60% are localized within 50 square degrees.
So I have no concept of how in 10 square degrees is that easy? Is it doable? Is 10 square degrees doable?
But it's tough. Depends on what you're looking for, right? So the wide field imaging telescopes have fields of, let's say, a quarter of 10 square degrees. So you can cover the 10 square degrees and kind of a single shot, or maybe a few pointings.
This is an optical.
Yeah, maybe optical. But then, who knows how deep you need to go, what the time scales are for the counterpart.
The one thing that you do have is that you don't know where you are on this plot.
Oh, yeah, we know, yeah. We see a source.
It might be 10 or it might be 6.
But I'm just saying that
we know our localization.
Right? If you say that the only effective searches you can carry out are less than 10 square degrees, then you're talking about a fifth of the source.
Yeah.
So if your weight is really 40 per year, or maybe 10 per year, actually going to affect them. And in the radio, it may be even more complicated. It depends on what facility you're going to use.
But still, even if it's a tenth, it's way better than 11.
But the question is, how many of them are going to be at, one square degree where you really do something interesting?
But by the time it's at a tenth, right? That probably is saying your best bet for a joint observation is a gamma ray burst. Because you've already localized it for us. We can dig a little bit deeper in our noise because, we know it's within these 6 seconds. We know where to look. And a tenth of things being seen as gamma ray bursts, if we're covering the whole sky with gamma ray burst monitors, is reasonable. So,
We can talk about that. That depends on
soon beaming and rates could just not work. Can you show the localization before arriving to the final design? So the only other one I put 3 or 4 in this talk. This was at design. This is no signal recycling. So this is just, where's the noise curve? There's no high frequency sensitivity. There you go. That's the no signal recycling, right? This is not on the current design path. It's just illustrative that if you don't care about the high frequency, you don't localize the signal, right? The bandwidth of this is about half of that. So the areas go up by about a factor of 4, right? So people are hearing this stuff, though. And they're even, the guys who are working on squeezing, which change the noise curve and actually give you even better high frequency sensitivity broadband squeezing. One of the arguments they're pushing now is we've localized that. You get the same range, but you get higher bandwidth, and so you localize better. And also you get to learn some merger physics and stuff.
Yeah, I'd be willing to bet a dollar that if LIGO New goes through, it won't have an advanced LIGO identical design telescope. We'll think about optimizing it maybe to get extra, we don't need to worry about so much of the detection, it's all can we squeeze out from maybe sacrificing low frequency sensitivity to get more high frequency sensitivity to get better localization. Or the question of staying waveform end effects.
So what was the for the big dog event, what was the area on the sky? It was
It was massive.
Yeah.
It was. It was a couple hundred square degrees.
So that was a detection with both LIGO detectors and inverter?
That was this 884 type detector.
Yeah, it was LIGO. It was a double quick something. It didn't actually show up.
But it was relevant.
I
thought that basically everything would have looked exactly the same for a
Well, the localization would have been worse, actually, because not having the Virgo signal kind of limited.
It didn't see anything significant. There was maybe a blip in there.
Okay, but so how did it not end up a ring? Why is it 200 square meters? If Virgo barely detected it, it was just essentially a LIGO detection.
Because it did limit the ring, right?
Okay, so you said it was not so Virgo was important in getting it down to 200 square meters.
Yeah,
from 2000.
Yeah.
So,
what
is it?
I mean,
what number is it?
I mean,
is 10 interesting or is that
how? It's interesting. 100 is, I think, really. 1,000? You can do a search on 1,000 square degrees. It's just not going to be an effective search. I mean, if you image 1,000 square degrees, that's not an issue.
So you would say it's somewhere between, in the 10-inch regime, that's where people can start.
The message we've heard at this conference and workshop repeatedly that I'd just like to sanity check one more time is that if we know we saw something in 10 square degrees, people will go after it. If we think, oh, maybe there's a signal in that 10 square degrees, can you add confidence by doing another search? The sense I've got is that this is not feasible. Is that the right message to take home?
Because I think unless you actually know exactly what you're looking for and that not seeing it means something, right? I mean, right now I don't think we can say that because we don't know exactly what signature we're looking for. In fact, we thought we were looking for optical emission from a kilometer, and now we're being told that we're infrared. I think that it will take a few detections to actually understand if the counterparts look unique in any way, and then you can say, oh, I didn't see something. That means something.
Yeah. And if you see it on your fourth arm, does it have a detection? If you do see something, you don't know.
Yeah, we don't even discuss issues that also.
I mean, it could be just random.
We have 100% confidence in everything we say.
But I think this is something really important we need to communicate in collaboration, which is stop talking about pulling triggers out of the noise or putting out, one a week triggers that we think people might get confidence for. Because people are talking about, what rate of triggers will the astronomy community tolerate? Is one a week okay? Is one a month? And it seems like if you're not sure this is something we should be looking at, we're not interested.
If I had a 20-centimeter telescope for my own personal use that can image a wide field, I don't care. Give me as many things as you want. I'll do the search if I'm not doing anything else.
Right.
It's not necessarily going to be a very effective search in finding counterparts, but I might be willing to tolerate.
As long as how often this kind of events happen, and then
if I had to use LSST to do the follow-up, then you're not going to tolerate it.
But what are you going to get out of that search with a handful of 20-centimeter telescopes?
Probably nothing, but people can still do the search. So I think at that level, it really depends on the, what you want to match the kind of scarcity of a resource, to the rate.
So the other question I try and ask, and I maybe it's just not how astronomers think, is you got your 20-centimeter telescope and you're going to point at these things, right? Well, PTF's been pointing all over the sky for months and years. Pan-STARRS is pointing. All these very sensitive things are pointing, right? Wouldn't they have seen something by chance if there's any hope in hell of you seeing it in your little telescope, right?
Maybe. I mean, you're still talking about 40,000 square degrees versus 10 square degrees.
But they've done a million pointings by now, or whatever, 10,000, 100,000 pointings by now, right?
But there's also a lot of stuff. My impression is that a lot of stuff is seen and just not. I mean, there's no systematic we're looking for anything that does anything, and that's just...
So if it's a bare detect, it's a kilonova, but it's just at your threshold, if you don't have any other reason to think to look harder at that data, you won't.
Right.
Yeah, so it could be in your data stream.
Okay.
I mean, it has been described, a lot of data, so you would imagine, you could imagine that right now you could do a systematic search, maybe of archives or whatever, and get limits on all of this stuff.
Yeah. And is that just not something people are interested in?
Well, it depends on if you're looking for something on, some optical counterpart on the time scale of the day. There are not a lot of searches that are sensitive to those time scales. The rates are still low. I mean, think about the rate you're talking about, right? I mean, it's 10 to the minus 5, or let's say, 10 to the 4 per gigahertz per second.
Yeah.
The supernova rate is significantly higher.
Yeah.
You're still looking for a relative.
But there's quite, for 20 centimeters, I guess the point is, how bright would it have to be seen? And then, the rate those you'd probably see, if something were that bright, you would notice. You'd certainly notice it.
If you're doing an optical search, you're always sensitive to supernovae more than anything else, because their rate is high.
Right.
And so at any brightness threshold, the thing you'll find most of is supernovae. And they're relatively easy to write.
Right. In terms of relatively easy, right, though, because I'm going to push back a little bit on this, we release a, trigger a week or something that's a sub-threshold trigger and people put the little robotic telescopes. I mean, are they easy to recognize in the sense that, with a telescope like that, you have a couple of bands and you can say it's behaving like a supernova, or it's actually being real spectroscopy that then actually means real follow-up? Is there anything you can... I still haven't heard a convincing argument, serendipity is the astronomer's friend if it's bright enough, but I've also heard Tree give a pretty negative opinion of, these just doing stuff randomly. So if there's no opportunity cost to do this, then okay, you maybe don't do it, right? You have a little network of these, telescopes with a, that are basically glorified digital cameras with a scope on the front. But what are you going to, basically just maybe, or can you actually get anything out of that that would be useful?
I think it really depends on what signature we expect. If we expect this, kilonova type thing, and it is in the optical, those things are fairly low luminosity, 100 times less luminous than a supernova. So at these distances of 200 megaparsecs, you're not going to find them with a small telescope. You need a few meter mass telescopes to do a search that's effective in finding that particular signature.
And what I care about is the opportunity cost, right? I mean, it's not free to put out a trigger a week and then do the analysis. I mean, we saw
it. But it depends. I mean, if your rate is really one per week, right, which is more or less what's expected, the best bet rate is of order one per week of high confidence.
But we'll know that before we get to one per week, right?
Yeah.
I mean, following that commissioning scenario, that means we'll see one at the 100 megaparsec range.
Yeah.
And so, by the time we know our rate's one per week, you'll probably accept 1.5 per week and, 20% of them are junk, fine. But if we have seen zero, would you take one per week?
That's the key thing, right? I'm not talking about in the early era when people are pulling this stuff out the noise, they're putting, we'll put out a trigger that has a false alarm rate of one per week.
Right.
We have no idea.
That's the key.
Yeah.
These are almost certainly not sources. And I mean, as long as it's clear, if you put out the false alarm rate with it, then in some sense, the community has to decide how to allocate resources.
But at some point I thought Swift had this thing where they had some guidelines and they were releasing stuff. And in the end, they made it a little bit more open because people wanted to at least have the chance to look at even the data and make their own decision on whether they follow it up. So
Swift has a very kind of specific fine-tuned threshold to reduce the number of false events to an extremely low number. But they are going now below that threshold with the understanding that there's going to be more false positives, and they provide that information. So you know that a particular trigger coming in is a sub-threshold trigger, and then, I'm not going to spend my, 8-meter telescope time on it, but somebody with a 1-meter telescope.
Right.
And where is that? Do you know roughly what those sorts of false alarm rates are?
I don't know exactly how they...
Like one in 10 years, or is it one a week?
Yeah, it's not one a week.
But Swift also has PixArty, which immediately sees variability, so there's...
Yeah, you can use that as an additional discriminator.
But psychologically, at what point do you think you get fed up? Okay, I go, I got my beam, my small telescope, I go, and at what point,
Maybe somebody will do that search for a year, search, 50 error boxes, and eventually say, these things don't have problem. So go do something else. Go back to Excel points. it's really hard to tell, but I think that the events that have the best, so to some extent, what I was driving at with the fraction is that you don't need to do a follow-up on all of them. If the rate is high enough that you can afford to just do follow-up on 10%, a few events per year, but those are going to be the golden events. They're going to be a few square degrees. You're going to have a lot more information because the gravitational wave data will have higher signal-to-noise ratio. And maybe those are the only ones that really merit so serious search.
I mean, I think, you know... Okay.
But that puts us at 2020, right? Yeah. What you're saying is, if you only want to follow up the most interesting 10%, then I need 10 events to really care. And what you're saying is, call me in 5 years.
The question here is, in the initial stages...
Yeah.
Well, it takes 3 years to remember who each other are, right?
That's right. If we're in a steady state, 2020-ish, right, we know the rate, rate's 40 per year, we buy Chris a beer. We have 40 per year, so we know we send out one a week.
For why?
Then what we're sending out is real detections. And there probably isn't going to be anything, but you can point your robotic telescope, and if there's something bright enough, maybe a particularly bright kilonova, you might get lucky. That, I think, is perfectly reasonable. And then you do more detailed follow-up with a few that allow the localization. But the question is, as Dan was saying, what happens before that, right? How much investment should we have in one a week?
I think the community will vote with its feet, in the sense that people are excited about this, and so they're willing to devote resources. But it's just like the GRB game. If you look at the amount of resources going into GRBs now compared to what it was in the mid-1990s, when the positions were very poor and delayed by hours, it's much better now, right? Because that if you spend your 8-meter telescope time, you're going to get a detection, you're going to get a spectrum, you're going to learn something new. But nobody invested that kind of effort in 1995.
And I think that's what we saw with the N6 dances, right? I mean, people were willing to point telescopes and then send you the FITS file, right? And so then
you do your analysis because we're not able resources now. I guess the trick there is going to keep the mind open that the bright and close by events could be in that stage when we're really not at the routine detection. So the community is going to have to keep an open mindset.
I think that's why there's a real desire to understand what the numbers are.
For your decent track rate, what is the sort of false alarm rate where you would still consider pointing a telescope?
It's not so much a false alarm rate, it's more what kind of area of the sky do I think I can effectively search.
Right.
If you told me that you can give me a high rate of events that are real, but all of them are going to be 1,000 square degrees.
Yeah.
I'll probably go and do something else, right? Because it's going to be really tough, and there are only a few facilities.
One square degree, but a false alarm rate of 70%.
It's the same.
Yeah, maybe then.
So then, what we would
be doing? You're not going to have things with one square degree and a high false alarm rate, right? Because those are going to be the biggest threshold by definition.
Well, you might get a lucky, but yeah, I guess the lucky part of the sky at threshold is still 5 or 10 square degrees. So yeah.
All right, so what happens if it's the loud nearby events, but we still don't have Virgo? So at that point, we may have a really high signal-to-noise ratio, very low false alarm rates, and crappy construction. So at that point...
Yeah, so what are the positions with just two LIGO detectors?
It's a ring on the sky.
It's a ring on the sky, 2,000.
Yeah, but then, if you had that early on, that it has to be relatively nearby.
And then you can
maybe you put all the stops and you just say, I'll find all the galaxies in that several thousand square degrees within 20 megaparsecs and just
go nuts.
Target each one of the individual. Maybe that'll be the approach. And hope that.
But again, you won't do that if it's, a one a week false alarm.
No, but if you had SNR 2020 in LIGO, and LIGO is not operating, or LIGO doesn't come
in. On the other end, if it is close by around that time, others may see something. Right. There may be GRB, there may be some
just
other.
Just by the by.
Yeah.
Not if it is
the local.
There was one other little thing I wanted to mention. We talked about GRB opening angles and stuff, and whether we can measure that with gravitational wave detections. And there's one. I have to write two equations and draw a simple plot that hopefully explains.
I have a question actually before we get to that. So the factor of 2.26 provides that fact. I mean, that includes two things. One is the orientation of the binary, and one is the orientation relative to the detector.
Yeah.
If it was just the orientation of the binary, just the face on.
It's about a 1.5 factor on each, right? And then that's squared.
It's
about
2.2.
Yeah. You know,
thinking along the GRB lines, because they would not necessarily be overhead, but they would probably be face-on.
Yeah,
this is
about a 1.5.
Yeah. In the conference, that, you know, assume it's face-on, and then you can break some of the, you have less degeneracies.
So if the amplitude of the signal in the the H plus and H cross signals would look something like. So the signal you're going to get in H plus is again, you've got this H, you've got the two phases, and then there's an amplitude in front of each of the two phases, and you've got these amplitude factors, and then the polarization angle sort of determines how much of each bit you get. And the H cross signal is a similar equation that I just can't be bothered to write. Okay? But the point is, you know, these are the two factors you get that determine the amplitude of the signal that you see in H plus and H cross. And so if you get both H plus and H cross, right? So in other words, you're sensitive to both polarizations of the wave, then in principle, you can measure all of these parameters. Because you get the amplitude and phase in each detector, and I have to worry about measuring four parameters, D, iota, psi, and phi naught. I've set phi c equals zero just because I couldn't be bothered to write long equations. Really, the only two things I want you to pay attention to are these amplitude factors, right? And I can just about plot them, I think. Iota, so cos iota should be easy enough. And then this is 1 plus cos squared upon 2, and it goes. Or something like this.
Okay.
So this is 1 plus cos squared iota by 2 in green, and this is cos iota in white. Okay? And so this is at 1, whatever, it's sort of at 40 degrees. I worked out a couple of numbers. So 40 degrees, you know, both of these are basically equal, and they're basically 0.75. And so the point is, what I can measure is this quantity and that quantity. And what I want to infer is the distance and the inclination angle. But at small inclination angle, these two things are equal. And so I'm just going to get equal amplitude in both. And I'm not going to be able to tell you whether the inclination angle was zero or the inclination angle was 40 degrees. Okay? Because all I'm going to say is those amplitudes were the same. This is about a 1 or 2% different by the time I get to 40 degrees, which I'm not going to be able to tell in threshold noise. Right? So what I'm going to just tell you is that I saw something with equal amplitude plus and cross. I might be able to tell you, actually, it was over here with negative sign on one of them, because obviously cos iota keeps going down negative, and this guy comes back. So I might be able to tell you if it's face on or face away, which I'm not sure you care too much about, but
there's a one-sided joke.
Yeah. Look at the bottom.
but the point is, I don't think we're going to be able to say much is inclination between 0 and 40 degrees, and then equally that the amplitude uncertainty here is about 25%. So I don't see how we get the distance to better than about 25%, right? From this simple plot. There's another thing which is a little frustrating as well.
Actually, on this book, this comes back to a question Lars asked, right, which is if you want to do join EM to leave the GW observations, what do you need the EM community to tell you? What can't you do? And one of the things we talked about is degeneracy between black hole, neutron star, right? If there's not the black hole. Here's another thing, right? If we want to get the inflation angle, it's really useful to have a distance from you guys to break that degeneracy.
Yeah, if you measure the distance, we get the inclination angle out because you've told us that, so I know this.
But also, if you can independently measure the inclination angle.
Yeah. And then the other you know, cute thing to observe is if you could tell me you're safe to assume that the opening angle is 8 degrees, I just picked this because then it's the unsafe, you know, this is 0.99. So if you can say the opening angle is less than 8 degrees, I get the distance to 1%. Right? And I think sometimes when people want to measure Hubble constants and stuff, Dan should correct me if I'm wrong here, but we make this assumption. We say, you know, if we're convinced the opening angle is small, we get the distance very nicely. If we don't, we're kind of hosed.
But they have numbers up to 10, 20 degrees.
Yeah.
So what's at 20 degrees?
Cosine 20 degrees? It's 0.95 or something. So that, you know, I don't see how we will measure this very accurately without an EM counterpart or, you know, jet break or redshift.
That statement applies to even if you include higher harmonics.
I haven't done the detailed calculation, but with higher harmonics, it always comes back to the fact that the place where the higher harmonics have the least effect is face on signals, right? The higher harmonics are most significant when you're edge on or nearly edge on. And in fact, also precession has least effect when you're nearly face on, because you get good response to everything. Precession's interesting when you're sort of dipping through being edge on and face on and whatever. So, you know, this may get somewhat better. I don't see a compelling reason to believe, you know, suddenly we'll be able to get the inclination to 5 degrees, 10 degrees.
So for the GRB case, there is another factor that might help that keeps getting discussed, which is narrowing down the time window and therefore pushing down on the SNR. So what do you think that is?
That is just, how much more sensitive can you be if you limit the time? I think it's 25%. I think I can even persuade you that maybe that's the same thing to say. 25% for a model, you know, compact binary match filter search. We have this plot that we like to draw, right? Which is signal to noise ratio, this is combined. So it's, you know,
it's
root sum squared of the SNRs and all the different detectors. Didn't seem worth writing that behind the whiteboard. And so maybe 12, 11, 10, 9. And roughly speaking, for one change in SNR, this is the number of false alarms. This is a factor of 100. This is a log scale, as is obvious. This is a factor of 100. So roughly speaking, for every unit increase in SNR, you drive down the false alarms by a factor of 100. This is a really useful back of the envelope thing to have. And actually, this big dog blind injection thing is where we did all the work to work this out. And this holds true down to, you know, a false alarm rate of 1 in 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 years. And so now how am I going to do this? So if I want to go from a year of data to 10 seconds of data, that's about a factor of a million. Right? So if I thought I could detect here, I can now detect here, which is give or take 25%. Right? There's just a million fewer trial scopes, so it's a millionth of the time.
It's 25% in the SNR, so what does it mean for the volume?
25% in distance.
In this, sorry, 25%
in distance. SNR is distance.
Yeah.
So you go one in SNR.
And you go two orders of magnitude in false alarm.
You go two orders of magnitude.
Yeah. It's pretty steep. So this is just a hand waving, you know. And it's about, and the numbers tally, you know, from having done our searches on the gamma ray bursts and blah, 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 what the loudest events tend to be, they're about 25% quieter than what comes out of the, you know, months of data. So.
So I mean, this, I assume it's consistent if you just take sort of this Gaussian, you look at number of sigmas, you're saying if I change the number of sigmas and I look at e to the minus.
I mean, this is e to the minus rho rather than rho squared, right?
Right.
So it's because it's a straight line here. But this is observed. I don't think it would be too different than actually going back to the theoretical thing and mucking with stuff. But yeah, this is just a nice sort of rule of thumb.
So this is SNR in a single detector?
No, it's combined.
This is the network. This is to detect the network.
Do you need to detect it with? And I'm just trying to play out the scenario. You have you have a GRB, you're going to your data, that seems like something in a single detector.
Until we've seen 10 things, I don't think we're going to see something in one detector.
I'm not necessarily asking as the first time around, yeah. But just as a general, you know, what would it take to. I guess this analysis takes that into account. Yeah. The pulse alarm rate is built in correctly.
The way we do actually the GRB analysis is we do it right. We do this coherent thing, right? When you know where the things are coming from in the sky, you can stack the data appropriately and work out sensitivity to plus polarization, cross polarization, and null streams, which have no gravitational wave left in them. And we do that. Of course, when you've got to search the whole sky, it's a pain because you've got a time shift, and then how much goes into plus and cross varies all over the sky. But for the GRB search, we do that, and so. In principle, you could have something loud in one and kind of not seen in the others, giving you enough SNR.
That's pretty loud. And the other
if the two LIGOs,
right?
Yes. So if the two LIGOs are on, chances are they'll be about equally sensitive, and there's not many positions in the sky where you get a factor of three more SNR in one of them than the other. Yeah. So
that still gives you a factor of two in the volume.
Okay. But there could be the due to spectrum
and the exact. That's right. Yeah, so you could have a LIGO Hanford with Virgo or LIGO Hanford with India or something, in which case the bigger ratios are more same.
And isn't this SNR go as a log of number of clients or force log or something?
So in principle, yes. If the noise is Gaussian, you can work all these things out, and this is chi-squared distributed with 2 degrees of freedom, and blah, 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 blah. In practice, use this because this is actually from the real data and the real search. Right? I don't think it's actually that different, other than there are far too many papers that say we're going to detect at SNR 8, which is junk. Right? You know, I would carry 12 around as a network SNR where we have a confident detection. Right? Which is a 50% difference. Thankfully, we've pushed on all the rates. Now it's single detector SNR of 8, which is very close to being a network. About 12.
12 is, there is 8 squared.
No, it's 8, 8, 4 would give you 12. 8, 8, 4 would give you 12, right?
8, 4.
Yeah. Or something like, 7, 7, 7 would give you 12 as well. But so yeah, our rates are okay, because we do single detector 8, which is equivalent to about where we
so
do.
I'm just trying to catch up with you. So you're asking, so if I know when it happened, this is the benefit. I also know where it happened, so I also get to the same thing for spiral precession.
Well, it depends on what kind of instrument detects the gamma ray trigger. I mean, if it's something like Fermi GBM, the positions are just as bad as LIGO. So, but at least you have the.
Sorry, just as bad as LIGO.
It's fine.
Good.
Yeah, it's fine for us.
It's okay for us.
No, it's okay for them. It's okay for them.
So
no, that's
we'll
awesome.
Also get to push this because of that.
Yeah, it's about another maybe factor of 10 or something.
All I'm saying is that it's even better than what you were.
So that's what I was asking. I mean, is the factor one, the 25% takes into account all the benefits, or is it just the time window?
The time window is the biggest one, right? The point is, because we don't localize very well, that if the effective number of trials on the sky is not huge. So actually localizing maybe buys you, an order of magnitude in trials factor, which is not, that much compared to the 10 to the 6 in the time. So.
Now, there's one effect that's not taken into account here, though, which is, to do a full, mild GRB, you've seen this business, assumption there that you probably face on or close to face on. I was thinking for the spinning search, you know, you're going to lose SNR, your trials factor goes up, but if you get the scalar localization, that restricts you. So you probably, you know, probably comes out in the wash about the same. Because if you did the full spinning search, you'd increase the trials factor, but if you did the scalar localization, you bring it back down.
Yeah, 25% there. It's about a 50% gain there from being face on or nearly face on.
So the volume goes up by somewhat less than an order of magnitude.
Yeah.
Which I guess doesn't compensate for beaming.
That's right.
So you're still losing in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to get as many GRBs as all sky, especially if the whole sky is not monitored in GRB.
You know, if it ends up being 1 in 10, because you gain an order of magnitude in the volume, and you lose the factor of 100 in beam. But I think we should maybe revisit this next week or something, because there's still
questions from here.
We're already booked for tomorrow.
What can we discuss?
We can discuss it over
coffee.
So, I have a question. I suppose there are some subjects of GRPs, derivational wave subjects for the GRPs being carried out. Is there something interesting to know about that?
Yeah, well, there's papers.
What
are the results of our search?
You mean the limits?
Oh, the current limits on GRPs.
Yes.
They're not. I mean, one in fact, near my, they're essentially.
Yeah.
We know that there are some potential.
Yeah, so these are the exclusion distances from the latest paper we put out, right? So that one is for an unmodeled ghost source, which Larry can say more about. And this is for neutron star black holes. And you see they're in the tens of megaparsec range. So we're saying it's not within tens of megaparsecs.
There's some of these have redshifts that are measured and they're, you know, redshift half or something. So it's not surprising.
Yeah. This one is it's our recent paper on a 7-year-old GRB that happened the day before our fifth science run started, which is part of the hassle. We asked the instrumenters whether we could use the data. It took a while for them to be convinced. So this one, 05-11-03 overlapped M81, right? And that's that band there, right? And then basically, this is a nice thing. You exclude as a function of opening it, right? So if you assume it was basically face on, we'd have seen a binary neutron star out to 6 megaparsecs. I think these are 90%. If you allow any orientation, then even if the thing's really close, there's an orientation, right? It's edge on and horribly oriented, that you don't get any signal. And so that's why you drop off. You know, we can't exclude, you know, that 3 megaparsecs if you don't assume any beaming. But, you know, if you assume 20, 30 degrees, right, it wasn't in that galaxy.
But that also is assuming you're not spinning.
The simulations were done with spin.
Okay.
Right, the search doesn't use spin. That's something I didn't mention when I was talking about this stuff. We always stick in spinning signals just to check we're not being killed. And we do okay. We could probably do better. And so all of these are done with reasonable assumptions on neutron star black hole spins and mass.
Now, Franz was making the point that you wouldn't catch those if they were eccentric, if they were captured by orbit.
Yeah.
So this is strictly if they're long-lived binaries that are quasi-circular zones.
Yeah. The other number that I think is in the recent GRB paper that's worth mentioning, if you do this unmodeled burst search, we just say I'm looking for a transient, and you put you put in simulations which are neutron star or neutron star black hole merges. The burst search picks them up because they are bursts, but the exclusion distance is about a factor of 2 worse, right? Because you're not modeling the whole waveform as it sweeps through the band, right? So if there is something that has the same amount of power, but doesn't, you know, is eccentric and doesn't match our templates and blah, 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 just, you know, take these distances here or here and lose about a factor of 2. And we do that search on all the GRBs. So we have that sort of, you know, safety net of, you know, getting everything if our models are wrong, but you lose about a factor of 2.
I mean, I stole
your thunder, right?
<We're done.
laughs>
Sorry.
That's
okay.
There was some mention of consonant versus coherent. I mean, maybe we don't want to discuss that now, but I would like to hear more about that at some point.
For CBC just type?
Because
the burst, right, so the burst approach is coherent, right?
Right.
So
why Bernie's approach for coherent CBC is nonsense?
I mean,
the numbers in that paper from Schertz are, we assume in a coincidence search, each detector had to have an SNR of 8. We assume for a coherent search, the whole network had to have an SNR of 8. In reality.
But besides this.
But that number, Benny says coherent search should be a factor of 5 better, right? Well, the thresholds are just completely wrong.
But it's just a number. So if I do a coherent with 12, yeah, then am I getting a reasonable? Then it's fine.
Oh. Yeah.
That's why I said I think your SNRs were a bit optimistic in that.
Okay, so 10 is optimistic, 12 is more reasonable.
There's also a misconception that our coincidence search is, you know, factor of 3 worse than it could be if we can.
Well, for us it's very important because of the noise suppression in the burst model search. So it's a little different.
It's usually the same
right?
thing.
It's just the level of false alarm suppression that you do just by requiring coherence. So the burst search has been coherent now for a while. Maybe I can show you how it works. But
yeah,
I think that's what you're
wanting
to
hear.
It's not just for me, for the people that
throwing around jargon.
So
one thing, given that we're in danger of running out too much time, one thing that we haven't done yet is we said we would have maybe smaller meetings in the afternoon for people interested in discussing more technical stuff.
Yeah,
we could maybe carry this on tomorrow afternoon. People can think about what they want to hear a bit more this afternoon. We can email the list and say, hey, can we have a little bit more technical discussion of X, Y, and Z?
Or we can do it on Fridays.
On Fridays.
Fridays, there are no other.
They're still here on Friday.
Not to overload.
Because some people can digest what they've done this morning. Let Laura digest what we heard this morning. Email out to the Chirp Squad list and say, you know, maybe a little bit more on this. That gives people a chance to prepare, and then on Friday we can have detailed discussion of these things, and people are interested in do something else or come
So I guess the only thing I'm going to do now is to say just a couple of words about how different the burst search is from what Steve just described. So the idea of a burst analysis is to keep the model out of the search process as much as possible. So these are searches that were designed for short transients, less than a second long, just to give you an idea, and broadband over covering the frequency band for LIGO itself. So we don't do much filtering the same way as Steve just described. Instead, what we do is to build these time frequency maps of the data. So you can do that by doing Fourier transform, wavelet transformation. There are various types of transformation that we do, but we take our time series and have this, this is a second long stretch of data where this axis is time and this axis is frequency, and we build, go to this side, and we build these maps. And this is a simulated, and this is what is a simulation for a BBH signal, which is of short duration. And you will see the chirp structure, but also the merger and the ring down would be part of that. So this is, you know, the idea is to go and examine these maps and pull out the pixels that are brighter. So the time frequency blobs that are statistically in excess from the rest of the data. So that's the basic idea. And because the data has lots of transients in itself, so it's very easy, you know, this is a simulated stretch of data, so this was probably even Gaussian underneath, but you could easily have just
bright blobs in your data that are coming just from transients and things that are in there. So the problem in this kind of analysis, where you cannot chi-square to a waveform the same way the CBC analysis is done, is that you really need to suppress accidental coincidence across detection. So that's why this is designed to be coherent from the get-go, which means we take these maps and then we compare, you know, you to first order, you want the bright pixels to appear in the data from all three or four detectors that you're analyzing together. So the way this is done is by building this likelihood function. So it's a massive likelihood function where basically, so in this formula, this is the signal. This is what was called H on the board before, with your H plus antenna pattern, and K is the detector index, okay? And then you compare it to the data, and you just do, this is data square minus data minus signal square divided by the signal. So it's just basically a maximum likelihood, a chi-square. And then you maximize this over the parameters, which now are not the source parameters. So we're not talking about M1, M2, spin 1, spin 2, like was here before. Instead, now our parameter is pixel by pixel, what is H plus and what is H cross. So now the only constraint we have is the duration has to be within a certain range, and the frequency has to be in the band. So what's H plus, what's H cross, and then you also can vary the antenna pattern by changing the position. Okay, so basically this is all, as you maximize this likelihood function, you get the most likely H plus and H cross as a function of time and frequency, so you can reconstruct your waveform. And then you also get the location in the process. So you build, this is the combined likelihood map, you just maximize, and so then you can pull out what's your signal as a function of time.
This only works right if each burst is above the noise?
You have to have, right. So basically there is a thresholding effect over here. So you want to have, you know, this is in whitened data. I kind of didn't say all the previous part. So you kind of whiten the data. So in that sense, this is really very close to the formula for the SNR in the match filtering process. Except again, the difference is that now H plus and H cross are part of your parameters. And so yes, it has to be above a certain SNR of 3 pixel wise in whitened data. And then you want to have something bright coherently throughout the waveform.
If you had a black burst, let's say from a new transtar and transtar merger, why would you submit that loud? Probably not.
You have a neutron star, neutron star, at that point your signals would be probably diluted. So that's why at that point you're better off just match filtering with the waveform.
Right.
So if you are, you know, if you only have the end of close to merger, at that point, you know, it's how compact the signal is in your time frequency map.
So I think that's why both burst and match filtering could miss something. I guess that's what I'm saying. Both burst searches and match filtering could currently miss something, like what Franz is talking about, highly eccentric binaries where each burst is too quiet.
Right, so in that kind of signal, you would have a kind of a quiet blip here, and one quiet blip here, and one quiet blip here, and you're not looking specifically for that. So what you need to do there is to have some stacking process to pull out periodicity. Yes.
Right, so I'm just saying we shouldn't be glued to say first searches would definitely catch it.
Why? I don't know.
They would catch it if one of the final blip is loud enough to be above threshold. Otherwise, what you can do.
Any of the blip is above your threshold, then you're.
Right, exactly. I think what they were talking about was to kind of find some stacking process that recognizes that there was some weak signal below your detection thresholds that's repeating, so you could do some Fourier analysis of your bright pixels or something like that, to pull out some periodicity.
Well, but
it would require.
You could have one of these parabolic encounters would go and then get out. So, I mean, the stacking wouldn't work there.
But
it's the same kind of argument that you don't think of a particular sequence.
But again, the other thing is, don't forget, the rates that we're talking about are rates from circular field binaries, right?
Sure.
So then, you know, maybe there's an extra population, you know, Koski's low, but O'Leary, you have this paper. Mm-hmm. When you talk to Stoll, the limit combination of Stoll and Cole. when you talk to, you know, Still basically said that rate's way too optimistic.
Sure, everyone says that, but nobody knows. If you ask them what the rates really are, they'll say, well, actually, I don't really know.
True, but the point is you're not taking a bite out of the 40 per year by doing
this. No, you're not.
And again, it's a question of opportunity cost, right? We know you can figure out in match filtering what the loss in fitting factor is as you increase the eccentricity, and you know for initial for reasonable eccentricities, the match filter search still has a good overlap.
Right. I just want to be clear though that you can't make the claim that a nearby gamma ray burst simply there was no possible candidates for it, for instance, or not nearby, even far away. I'm saying that there could be something in the data that has not yet been searched for. That's the only point I'm making. That there are claims that everything's been covered, that's not true. It's not true that every possibility variant has been covered in the searches.
Right. So now if I can add, there is actually,
of course.
Right. So the same way there are efforts now exploring alternative gravity, there are some people in the Burst group that are looking at, they're working with you guys also, right? At ways to be a little bit maybe smarter in the conditions that are applied to this formula. Right, so there are, you can, for instance, one of the things that has been done for the binary black hole searches is to put a constraint or regulator or some condition between, to constrain how the H plus and the H cross change so they're consistent with an elliptical polarization instead of letting them go wherever they want. Similarly, there are people that are looking now into how you can do this combination to give emphasis to kind of this eccentric binary. So it's not the main search that we do. It's one of the studies people are looking into. So it's not going completely unexplored. The part of it is we don't really know what we're looking for. So that's, we cannot be smart.
There's also a strong constraint for the ultra-centers, which is okay, because these guys inject huge amounts of mass, which is super optimistic. It could be 10% of the binary merger rate. Most likely, it's much cooler.
Right.
So if you do a search for a binary neutron star in this method instead of the match filtering, how much less sensitive is this approach?
How much for the BNS? BNS is about two.
The number
everything is two.
In the GRB paper where we did exactly the same simulations for both is about a factor of two.
Just like
Uncle Tour,
I would have said more.
But there's going to be, the problem for an advanced LIGO though, it's a factor of above a certain threshold, right? BNS, SNR 8, if you look at, this is something that's going to, people are going to need to get a head transfer advanced LIGO. BNS in a single detector SNR 8, even in gas signals, we see nothing at time frequency now. Just blue.
Because it uses all the lower frequencies.
Because the time frequency volume is.
Right. Huge. So. For this kind of searches, kind of how you cluster the contribution for the various pixels to bring the event, to get
so
the global SNRs and effect. So, right. So, in fact, I think above, when we start talking about black hole, possibly some sort of black hole, it starts to be competitive. And actually, I would say above 20 solar masses, the two approaches are hand in hand. If you go in initial LIGO,
right.
In the comparisons that we've done.
I never saw these comparisons. Is there a paper, or are you referring to a paper or study?
So I think in the comparison, the IMR groups, we started, I forget now. Now maybe it was more like 40 solar masses.
Yeah, I think
20 is. Yeah, sorry, it was more like.
2020 is still on the low mass search.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I think, I don't remember if it was 30 or 40 that we started that.
It would be nice to see some of these results before.
Yeah.
I heard some time, but I never saw.
Yeah, so, we could pull those out too. Yeah.
Is the claim advanced LIGO?
In advanced LIGO, it's a different spectrum, so, right. Advanced LIGO, it's a different spectrum. So the effect of the whitening of the sensitivity is going to be different. It's a different game, right?
I don't think we know the number, but it's the expectation. Signals longer, match filtering buys you more.
Yeah.
Or equivalently, in this case, the power is spread out over more pixels.
So
minimum is a requirement of detection into detectors.
Yeah.
Yes, without two detectors, it would be really, really hard.
There's no signal that will be loud enough in one detector that you will say, look, or the glitches at all.
I mean, sure.
Yeah.
If Livingston
we have some...
happened to get an SNR 100 that you saw in the, you could chill with the time freezing, you can hear it in the headphones. That I think people have
we get glitchy type. Right. So glitches, we could get SNR 1000. Just for noise transients, we get those things. And those are thrown away the moment you require coherence with the other detector. So it has to be consistent with the antenna pattern. So there has to be a sky location that allows for that difference in the signals between detectors. Even so, this kind of gets us to lose in terms of the SNR that we can declare a detection from. So it's an old plot, but I think I kind of like to use this to convey the idea of the impact of the noise on the searches. So these are noise curves for S5, so this is all data. So what you see here in the red dots are the expected sensitivities of a burst search for narrowband signals, short narrowband signals, so really bursty thing, blobs in the time frequency domain, if the noise is Gaussian. And this you would expect to be about a factor 3 above your worst noise. So this was the H2 detector, the shorter one. These are the two better ones. So you would expect to be in Gaussian noise about a factor 3 above the noise. Once you take into account the glitches that are coming in accidental coincidence and how you need to set the threshold to have a low false alarm rate, then you lose another factor 2 to 3, depending on the frequency. So we are effectively losing ourselves a factor 2 to 3 due to the noise and where we can put our threshold. So that's why a signal at SNR 10 or 12 in the burst search will not work out, because we have this non-Gaussian tail that comes out, and so we need to go much higher to be able to claim a detection with that confidence. This is if we don't put any limits, any constraints on what the signal is going to be. So then the approach that we are starting to explore more and more is, what if you put some constraint into it? So not the search, right? It's a semi-modeled, right? So you need. So for instance, when you're focusing on coalescences, you want to at least impose the constraint that the signal is elliptically polarized as opposed to linearly polarized. Then you can do tricks like, again, put some constraint on how you vary your parameters, and that can help you. Or same concept, you change, put a constraint on what are the locations, because you know that there was an external trigger that's telling you where to point, and that reduces your false alarm rate. So that's you know, constraining this, the way these parameters move can help you, or the frequency, or you know, if you're following, you know, certain models for certain supernova expectations, then you can do that.
I think for the GRB search, I may be wrong. I know they discussed it. I think they assumed it was circularly polarized.
Yes.
Because of this factor, right? That you sort of expect to be face on to whatever explosion happened.
That's right.
And this is doesn't matter so much in the two LIGOs, but if there's one when LIGO and Virgo are on, and they're sensitive ones to totally different polarizations, you've got two detectors here, and one sensitive to plus, one sensitive to cross, then anything is consistent, because you're freely varying H plus and H cross. So they found that if you have only two detectors, one LIGO, one Virgo, then for the GLP search, assuming circular polarization is really powerful. I don't know if this is I think it's a reasonable assumption, basically, for this sort of argument, that you expect the power to, this degeneracy in cosine iota.
Right. So I don't know how much time we have left now, but I wanted to just bring up what is that the burst search could constrain, because I think that may be the take-home message. This is something that I showed at the conference already, but just want to spend a couple of minutes, because I think this is what's, I guess one of the questions is, what can we do with various frequencies? And this is what's gonna tell you the reach for this type of searches. This is results from the S6 data, so it's still initial LIGO data. So what you see here is, as a function of the frequency, the detectable energy in gravitational waves at a fixed distance. So this plot, as in it, the assumption that we have a galactic source at a distance of 10 kiloparsec. So if we have a source there, how much was emitted gravitational wave energy that we could have detected? And so this, of course, depends on the frequency. It doesn't depend much on whether we're linear or circular polarization in this case. So we try different type of signals. So all these dots are different type of waveforms that we tested this with. So we tried the sine Gaussians are this kind of, it's just a sinusoid with a Gaussian envelope on it. Then we tried some ring downs and just band-limited white noise at a sort of kind of narrow band still. And so this kind of follows the noise curve. Our most sensitive region is in the buckets, so 150 Hertz. And we would be sensitive to order of 10 to the minus 8 solar masses in gravitational waves. So how do we map this into detectability for core collapse supernovae? Well, if we take the numerical relativity simulations that give us up to 10 to the minus 7, so somewhere in the galaxy we're sensitive to, you go to advanced LIGO, you get a factor 10, so you can say we can cover the galaxy for core collapse supernovae in most of these cases. If you go to the analytical models that are a little bit more extreme, I think yours are in here too, somewhere in this one. There were some paper from yours as well. So if you kind of go to these more extreme models that predict up to 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, then you can say, well, my reach then scales out to Andromeda for initial LIGO. We could reach out to the Virgo cluster for advanced LIGO, and that's how you can kind of map the potential for this type of searches with different type of sources, kind of pull out what's the energy in gravitational waves that could be emitted. And this scales with the distance, basically. So the farther out, the higher is the limit or inverse.
So the most extreme case is take the progenitors rotating very, very rapidly. So it's more rapidly than you believe they rotate. But if you take that extreme case, you can get the roots from it.
Right. So, you know, if there is a supernova in, I guess, up to Andromeda in this case, we could put some constraint on those models.
But I thought that with the recent results of last year's from supernovae, that because of the small asymmetry that they see in the collapse, advanced LIGO is not going to see supernova events outside our galaxy.
Right, so then we're back down to this.
So the other is really very...
They are, this extreme of,
So, I mean, if you look at someone who's made a model and they did a non-rotating star, it's pretty hard to make it have this wrong signal. So...
But
the simulations, the standard approach, you don't have all the physics in
Well, there was always...
In your ballpark, where things can change. I mean, the history of supernova simulation, I understand, could be very...
Although I think in the end, there's lots of people calculating signals from different turbulent models, but in the end, if you really want a strong signal, it has to be rotating rapidly.
Yeah,
that's
how. Right. I think the change was having the 3D simulations, and there was always hope that with the 3D we would have much higher production, which didn't pan out.
Just so I understand it. So basically, the claim is. So the frequency is the frequency at which it's being emitted, and then there's some number of cycles, roughly.
Order of 10, yes,
okay,
yes.
So as long as I dump all the energy at this frequency for 10 cycles, then these are the benefits.
Exactly. So if you have a more complex frequency evolution of your signal, you know, you kind of need to decompose it through this. But that if you're interested with the high frequency because of the spectral shape, so if you're going out to kilohertz, you're already losing three orders of magnitudes in energy. So that's why getting the post-merger signal is going to be really hard, because there it's the frequency. Now here, the limited high frequency is not so much the glitchiness. You can actually start being closer to the noise floor. But it's just the sensitivity that's good. So unless you have something really strong out there, it's going to be harder.
So from the discussion we had earlier about narrowing down the time window and the fact that it has a fairly minor impact, it seems like doing the MERS searches the other way. By let's say that I said, oh, you know, I found a supernova in, some galaxy.
Right.
No, in our galaxy, that's fine. Let's say I found a supernova at some galaxy at 5 megaparsecs, and I know the time of the explosion to plus or minus a day. It doesn't really help you in digging into your data.
For us, so we can do the comparison, just using this recent GRB paper results, where we kind of constrain the distance and the reach in our most sensitive band, so using this kind of 150 hertz. So we can compare how that went compared to this one, right? And so, in the search where we had the 150 hertz sine Gaussian, exactly the same kind of signals, we get to about, I think it was 17 is the median for this distribution of GRBs. So the median reach for a source that emits 10 to the minus 2 solar masses. So if we reverse engineer that, and we say, okay, what would be our sensitivity in the galaxy? Let me see what I did here. Yeah, so what if I take the old sky, if I take the old sky result and I scale it, what would the old sky search have given us here, taking the result from that previous plot? That would have given us order of 7 megaparsecs. So the old sky search would have put the limit here. So it's about a factor of 2, again, roughly, order of, that we lost by. There are some subtle differences in the way the search is done in the two cases. But effectively, if I take the untriggered search and compare it to the trigger search for the GRBs, where I knew the location and the timing, then I gain a factor of order of 2, 2.5 maybe, on average.
Doesn't that include the phase on component of the argument?
No, this is for the specific GRBs. Now then there's the other arguments. So if I, by having reduced my search to being in the neighborhoods of when I knew there was a GRB, I suppress my false alarm. I can go a little bit deeper out. I gain roughly a factor 2.5.
So you're saying that
if I know there is a GRB,
the effect of narrowing the time window is larger here because the false alarm rate is so much. You have that tail. Yeah.
That's right.
Whereas your core is in this case,
that's
you're not
right.
Gaining as much.
Exactly.
You have better control.
Yes, we gain more. Now, then the other side of thing is, if I only do a trigger search, what am I missing from the fact that I didn't get the EM signature, right? So then it depends on the opening of the GRB itself. And so if you combine both information, I think what Michal calculated is that if the beaming is really tight, so less than 5 degrees, and I combine how many GRBs I would have missed, so I'm better off doing the old sky search, basically we will get an order of a 10% of performance. If, however, the beaming is large and goes out to 30 or 60 degrees, I forget, I need to look it up. If it's edge-on, so at 90 degrees, then the trigger approach is 6 times better than the untriggered. So if you combine the two informations. So.
So it seems like narrowing the time window is actually
It is important. And also in the BERT search, I should also point out, we keep a wider window than in the CBC. So you guys are looking a few seconds, right? 1, 2, 5.
Yeah.
Right. The BERT analysis is keeping a broader window of, I think, up to 10 minutes before and 1 minute after. because it looks at all GRBs, not only the short GRBs. So it's an order of 10-minute window.
And your CSG 150 30-ish cubicles, 9-ish Sungaussians again?
Sorry?
Cubicles, 9 Sungaussians.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go. Any model that sweeps through the frequency band within 10 minutes and has some power at 150 or 300 hertz, that's a lot of 10 cycles of that frequency, 10 minutes before.
So for advanced LIGO, then these comparison numbers change, or is this?
I think the numbers, if you come, I think this comparing CBC to burst will be different in advanced LIGO. Trigger versus untriggered, I don't think so.
Trigger versus untriggered.
That should be the same. Yeah.
But it seems like there is value if one can do a nearby supernova search, an optical nearby supernova search that was designed to measure the time of the explosion as accurately as possible. There's value in that.
Yes. That's in fact, there are efforts ongoing to do targeted supernova searches, but the window is so large still that.
Because most of the searches right now will tell you the explosion time to at best plus or minus a day.
So you kind of lose it.
Plus or minus an hour or plus or minus 10 seconds.
What does it take? Why is so
high? Because the way you design a survey is to get enough objects, and the rate per galaxy is 1 per 100 years. So you need to visit many galaxies in your search in order to get a large enough number of supernovae, which means that you can't visit the same galaxies more than once per night or something.
You're
just interested about 5 megaparsecs. You know, if you said, let's take all the galaxies in 5 megaparsecs, of which there aren't that many, and just sit on them. So if a supernova happened in one of these galaxies once every few years, we'll at least know as precisely as possible what happened.
And how? What time it does? I mean, presumably that's
you don't need something very bright. You still want to, in order to get the time of explosion narrowed down as well as possible, you want to go well below the peak brightness of the supernova. Because you want to catch it when it's rising. So, maybe with a 1 meter telescope sitting on the nearest 20 galaxies or something.
So it's got to get above some threshold before you could ever possibly see it. And so how well do we understand the physics to be able to go back in time to get it with people? Do we really understand it well enough to say it's happened within certainly not 10 seconds?
No, 10 seconds.
So
unless you had some other signal like, trauma breakout in the X-rays or something. But that is a very narrow signal.
The other advantage, of course, of getting down to the hour, rather than day, is our duty cycle is not 100%. By the time you get to, it went off. Okay, and that point in the sky, sometime in the last 3 days, 20% of that time we'll have no detectors on. And so, we'll say we didn't see it, but you can't, it could easily be just our detectors are off rather than we look, so it helps in that.
There's one other thing we're talking about GRB search that came up when I was talking to Nora over lunch. But what fraction of the, say, Fermi GRBs do people not bother doing a detailed follow-up because they're not well enough localized? Is it really only a handful of the swift ones that are followed up?
All the GBM events are not followed up.
Right.
And those are, a couple hundred, 300 per year. It's the vast majority of the Fermi detectors.
Right, and they don't have redshifts because there's no follow-up, there's nothing. So there's value in LIGO rapidly following up everything that comes out of Fermi.
If it's a medium significance event coming out of our Fermi analysis, we get a Fermi trigger, we do an externally triggered search of this type. Mm-hmm. We come out with a so significance, but still,
every 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
Send it out.
Yeah.
Because I think that once you go from a Fermi, then all these issues are right, because then you know the timing very precisely. So there should always be a follow up by LIGO every GRB.
Yeah. Now the question for us is what's the time, the latency for this? That makes it interesting, right? So should we put all of our effort in making that happen? Well, on a short time scale, a week, a day, an hour.
Faster than a week, yeah.
A day or an hour. Great.
And again, this is kind of a low opportunity cost, high benefit thing, because the only reason we're not doing the GRB search more quickly is because we're not. There's no technical.
It's that actually it's a big endeavor to get significances and.
Yeah,
minutes would be better. So you're now saying GRB trigger. But you want the latency to check the ground threshold just to know if you should point something out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
if you see a GRB, you have something, maybe an interesting level of protection, then you can start thinking about what's the next,
Because otherwise, all you have is, you just know something happened, but if you're looking at a high rate of GRB triggers, then at some point you're right.
It would still be challenging because the Fermi, typical Fermi, localization is a order 5 degrees radius, circle. So you're not going to constrain it. So the challenge remains.
But if all error box, open an error box, and it's a 1 in 6 money, then it'd be so interesting.
The intersection would be pretty small.
That's true, yeah.
The shapes of the airbus are very different.
We might have an ellipse on top of the Fermi circle.
Yeah, so. It might look like the IPM Fermi kind of
thing.
Stuff like this, and so
But did you say that then the Fermions that are not thought up, there's absolutely no redshift information whatsoever, or there's some discriminating?
So Fermi has two instruments. One is called the GBM, the Gamma Reverse Monitor, which has a wide field of view and very poor localization capabilities. And a high detection rate. Those are not followed up. There's the large area also, which is the only detector, which has a small field of view and much better localization. Those events are followed up quite extensively, but we're talking about, instead of one per day, the detection of black is one per month or even lower than that. So it's a very small subset. The ones that would be interesting to the final searches on are all the GBM events that nobody else right now is following up in any way.
We followed them all up. And that's what these things are, right? So we do get
them. But so all of that open, so you're saying already, at least while it was online.
Yeah, no, we did all these. We're now doing the IPM GRBs. Yeah. They come in sort of manually a bit later.
Every Fermi and Swift in S6 has been followed up. But the question is, it sounds like, if we're going to do some interesting trigger release early, then this is a prime candidate because we have these GBM, they don't have any redshift.
The probability that you'll detect them is extremely low, but why not do the search?
Can you say something therefore, their redshifts must be greater than this if they're these kinds of systems?
Yeah, that's effectively what these plots are saying,
You have an exclusion
distance. We don't do redshift yet, because that'd be too
We're not quite yet.
He's still mega projects.
The only other thing that I just wanted to add is that in this kind of approaches, what we can do is, again, to constrain distances and the energy for the event. So how much energy was emitted. So for instance, in the two events, the GRB 05-11-03, 07-02-01 that we published on, so on those we did give a limit on the energy and gravitational wave that could be compared, for instance, to SGR production. The limit was still too high, but in the advanced LIGO era, that those may become more interesting limits. So that's something that we can work with, as well, again, with models that can guide our tightening up this searches in a semi-modeled approach.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.